Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Man, we've got a great guest today, one of the most talented guitarists out there. Man, he's got a new record out, and he's just a very incredibly warm, nice human being. We're with the one and only Kim Mitchell, most well known for being with Max Webster in a very long solo career. Couple of quick announcements. First, I want to thank our mutual friend Rick Emmett for connecting us. Rick, thanks very much. Second, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. And if you're watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe button on your right or below me or something like that, and the bell. We appreciate that. Quickly, Kim's background. Music veteran. He was a lead singer and guitarist for the band Max Webster. They released five studio records before going on to a solo career, where he's released eight solo records, including a new album coming out called The Big Fantasize. I have four tracks of the album. It is absolutely devastating, man. I mean, I think this is the best record he's ever put out. And I'm not saying it because he's here, and it's fucking amazing. It's his first album in 13 years. The songs that I heard is the first single, Wishes. And can I say the other songs I heard or not yet?
Sure, absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Okay, he's got Up to Be Down, All We Are, which is an old hit of his. Oh my God, it's a live version. And he has other live versions, but it's like when his solo on here, it's like, get ready for liftoff, man, because you're going on a trip. And Best I Never Had. Honestly, all four tracks, five stars in my book. It's incredibly melodic song. The mixing on there is phenomenal, man. Were you involved in any of that?
Well, yeah, the recalls. They said, yeah, it was being mixed in Los Angeles by Greg Wells, who produced the record. And we can talk about him a little bit, although talking about producers is kind of boring, right?
But he's an ex-bandmate of yours, isn't it? Greg used to play with you, right?
Greg Wells, who's now in Los Angeles, has done a couple Keith Urban number one songs, One Republic, Apologize. He did a lot of Katy Perry records, worked with Pink. He had a song on Adele's 21 record, did Speaking of 21. So he did 21 Pilots' first record. He did OTEP. He did the soundtrack to The Greatest Showman. He was born here in Canada. He was the son of a reverend. Reverend
Wow.
Wall, and at 17, he knocked on my door and said, I want to play in your band. And this is 17. I'm like, yeah, right, kid. First of all, how'd you find where I live? He goes, no, I want to play in your band. And he seemed nice enough. So I gave him just a ridiculous audition. He was good. He would be a keyboard player.
Right.
And so I gave him this audition where he had to play left hand bass and all these crazy ass chords on a song called City Girl. And I thought, okay, I won't hear from him for a couple of weeks. And the next day he calls and goes, okay, I'm ready. And we went to a room and he was just like, blew me away. He had pocket. I was like, how does a 17-year-old do this? He's got groove. He's got pocket. He's got attitude. So he was a pushy little prick the whole time. So I'm not surprised he did so well in LA. He just had that, right? Well, because most of the time Canadians are apologetic, but he just kind of went down there with not arrogance, but just being a pushy enough dude. And so he's done great. So he did the mixes. So he'd send me the mixes of the record. And I go, that's a little piece. Can you tweak that up? He was all about those little movements in the mix. Like, let's get this to where you love it. That's his whole attitude. Like, let's get this stuff to where you love it.
It's phenomenal. The mix is absolutely great, man. And this is why I liked you the first time I spoke to you, man. You just like, boom, right out there. You don't get that a lot. which is refreshing. You know, you just say it how you, well, like there's not much of a filter there, man. I like that. I'm the same way.
Would you like, okay, here comes the apologetic comedian. I'm sorry. Would you like me to put the filter in, Greg?
Absolutely. Please do not put the filter in, man. Okay. There's a ton of energy on the tracks, and I'm really happy to turn everybody onto it. Over his career, Kim's had 7 singles in the top 20 in Canada. Somewhere in the middle of all this, he also spent a little over 10 years as an afternoon drive time host on Toronto classic rock radio station, Q107. And over the course of his career, he's been on the same live bill with acts like Sammy Hagar, Def Leppard, Black Sabbath, Aerosmith, and Van Halen. You seem so conservative compared to all these guys. Were you like that? This laid back in the day?
I was sort of the shy, frostbitten Canadian backstage. Yeah. These guys are pretty badass.
You know? Yeah.
They're also sweet. I always found that the bigger they were, the cooler they were.
That's great.
You mentioned my radio career. We had an act in once. They were a tribute band to Led Zeppelin. And the dude was like, I said, well, can you sing something? He goes, no, man, it's Tuesday. You know, I don't sing on Tuesday. And, you know, if you were a musician, you would understand that. And my producer, who was on the radio show, he goes, dude, he is a musician and he plays his own music.
Yeah, right on. It's Tuesday. No Led Zeppelin on Tuesday.
But I find that most of the people I've met are just real salt of the earth.
Yeah.
You know, Eddie Van Halen and Sammy Hagar walked into the dressing room after a show, and of course, I'm freaking out.
Yeah.
I'm fanboying out, but because I'm meeting a legend. And by the way, a side note, I'm not dressed yet. I've just come off stage opening for them. And I'm sweaty and I'm just kind of in my underwear with a towel over your shoulder. And I'm shaking Eddie's hand and I'm pretty embarrassed. But it was a nice moment. It was just we just hung out for 10, 15 minutes, him and Sammy in the trailer with us. And then later that day, there's a bit of a story. Should I tell it?
Yeah, man, definitely.
Okay, so it's a gig. It's a gig outside, afternoon gig in Rochester, and there's just a ton of people in this. I'm not sure the name of the place, and we're on the side of the stage, on Eddie's side. I'm standing with my sound man and my light man, and there's a anvil case, a road case with Eddie's drinks on it at the side. So he'd run over and get drinks, and he comes running over partway through the set, like 4 songs in, and we're standing there. And he looks up at us and he goes, he takes a big drink of something. I don't know what it was. He goes, oh, man, sounds like shit up here today. And my light man goes, points out at the sound man, he goes, oh, yeah, you should hear it out there. I'm like, dude. Did you just say that to Eddie Van Halen? Van Halen kind of looks and kind of chuckled and kind of awkward and took off again.
That's pretty funny.
On the guitar.
That's great, man.
Yeah, because it kind of didn't sound like ass that day.
That's weird. But it was like an outdoor shed, though.
Yeah, it was an outdoor shed.
It's hard to get those things to sound good sometimes, man.
Yeah.
That's great, man. Kim, he's going to apologize after this because I'm going to allow talk about his accolades. He's a multi-platinum selling artist, a Juno Award winner, which if you guys don't know, it's like the Canadian Grammys, and he is being inducted, or did this happen yet? The Canadian Songwriters?
No. Yeah, it's going to happen. Yeah.
When is that happening?
After COVID. It was supposed to happen and then COVID hit. So,
after COVID, so like infinity.
Yeah. That's not my first almost moment, Craig. There's a couple others.
After COVID, he's being inducted into the Canadian he's the Canadian Songwriters Hall of Fame. And this is the best quote. I read this that you said. It's a compliment. This is like, I wish I had.
So first of all, let's just set this up by who's in there. There's people that your audience will know. Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Leonard Cohen, Gordon Lightfoot, who's more of a Canadian, but these are older vintage artists, legendary. So
it's a big honor. And,
it is.
Kim's comment. I've got to somehow get a plaque because, you know, once every like once a month at least, I get an amazing, cool quote like this that I wish I could just like look at and chuckle. This was what Kim said. It's a compliment to be associated with such a group of dysfunctional songwriters. I feel I am just as dysfunctional as they are. Touche, man. That was.
I'm gonna fit right in.
Yeah, that was perfect, well, man. That was. Aren't we all? I mean, that was great.
Well, we are as well as maybe the human race, but musicians. Though that list of people, they've had their stuff, and
yeah,
I said that because you know. The kind of people I kind of say this in a light way, in a humorous way, but the people you know in your life, they're like, hey, how are you? They're always engaged. They're looking at you. Everything you say, and they're reacting, and they're happy. And when something kicks them in the crotch, they're like, oh, well, you know, stuff like that happens in life. They're happy all the time. They're in tribute bands. They're not songwriters.
Yeah. Right?
They're happy, and I'm not saying we're not happy, but I think songwriters are a little more dysfunctional in relationships. They've had addictions, they've had all kinds of stuff happening, but that's been the fuel for their music, which I think is part of the mojo that makes it more relatable to everybody. Does that make sense?
I think it makes total sense. It was spot on. I think creatives in general tend to be a little more sensitive and a little more reflective and want to take that sense, the energy from that, and fuel it into their creative projects. 100%, man.
Sure. And I'm not slamming people who are happy, who are in tribute bands, because I played.
You bastards. You fucking happy bastards. Yeah, right.
I want to be happy too.
Man, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank I really you. Appreciate it. You're hilarious. And I'm so happy.
The
record is wonderful. All right. So if I read this correctly, you were playing in a band called Zoom, like Z with three O's, M. But then after high school, you left the band and went to the Greek islands. Now, how fun does that sound like for a high school kid to be hanging out? You know, especially right now, we're all in the middle of COVID. You can't go across the street. What prompted that trip? What did you get out of it, and what made you come back?
Okay, so after Zoom, 17 years old, you quit home, you quit school, you moved to the big city of Toronto, Canada. It was 3 hours away from your hometown. You grew up. The band did really well in Toronto. We were young kids. We did great, but we had to break up when the weather got warm because our fridge was out back of the house. The landlord, I swear, this is true.
This is the best breakup excuse ever.
Would not, that's true. The landlord would not fix the fridge. So everybody went, well, okay, we can't really feed ourselves anymore. So we're going to move back to our hometown. And I went back and I was ready to go back to school. And a friend of a friend got my phone number and went, do you want to come on the road with a show band? And I was like, what's a show band? I don't know. What is that? And he says, well, you work Monday to Saturday and you do three sets a night and we'll pay you $150 a week. And it's a Greek singer and a female singer, and we're the backup band, and we wear suits, sparkly stuff, and we do this thing, this Tom Jones thing.
Oh my God, like, that's awesome.
So, well, that's what I said. I've been in a tribute band now. So I was like, I'm down. Let's go. And then about a year into that, I was really enjoying it because it's steady cash and you're playing every night. You get to the practice during the day. He says, my family's building a nightclub in Greece on the Greek island of Rhodes. You guys want to come? So we went over there. And it was just like one of the most beautiful times of my life. I stopped smoking. I just lived really clean. The food over there is great. You're on a Greek island, playing music every night. There was no break. So it was 7 days a week. But it was fantastic. And during the day, I'd practice. I had a Gretsch Nashville that my dad bought me, this orange Gretsch Nashville. And just practice every day in my room. And the biggest decision of the day would be, am I going to turn left or am I going to turn right? And it was just a fantastic time of my life. And then you were saying, so that's what took me there. I loved it. But then I wanted to start, because I was practicing, I thought, I want to get a guitar teacher. And so I knew that I had to go back to Canada. And got the name of a private teacher who had a really good reputation. His name was Tony Braden. He's no longer here anymore. But I made plans to meet up with another musician in Windsor who ended up being in Max Webster. That's how we started Max Webster. And it was a jam we started, and it was the most awkward jam ever. It was like one of those jams where you go, ooh, that really wasn't happening. But we decided to give it a go and keep at it. So I moved to Toronto. We moved to Toronto to start Max Webster. And Max Webster was literally a bit of a revenue stream, so to speak, for me to take lessons from this guy for a year. And that lasted a year because did a little over a year because Max Webster started to do really well. And I just was getting so busy with the band and writing and recording and traveling that I couldn't keep up with the practice thing.
You did all the writing with Max Webster, correct?
Well, I did. And with another guy, Terry Watkinson, who was a keyboard player, he contributed the stuff that was actually really successful here in Canada. He was sort of a couple radio hits and stuff like that. And I was sort of the wacky dude that, I grew up on Captain Beefheart and stuff like that.
There's a lot of that in the Max Webster catalog. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. There's a little, okay. You can hear that actually. Well, it's funny. Greg Wells, working with Greg Wells on this record in Los Angeles. He's been there 20 years. And the first time he said something, and I went, "Oh, I'm sorry, Greg, I could have done that better." He goes, and he's Canadian. He goes, "Let me be the apologetic Canadian minister while we make this record." But he said, there really is a difference. Canadians are very much like that. He said, it was over a guitar solo. I said, "I'm really sorry, I could have done that better." He goes, "If you were an American, you would have gone." And he said, "It's great." He goes, "Listen to that, man. You're not going to hear anything better than that. It's amazing. Look at it. Check it out." The compliment. Like, I can't relate to talking like that. So that's cool.
No, it would if it was most musicians, they would have said, "God, I fucked that up. Let me do it again." That's probably what they would have said. Sure. Yeah, it'd be the rare sort of arrogant asshole that would say that. But you might hear that for sure, man. Easy.
It's a fine line, though, Craig, being a musician, though, you kind of have to walk with that confidence, and I call it cock. You have to walk with a lot of cock, and sometimes it gets perceived as being arrogant, but you need to have that confidence to do what we do, right?
I think it gives other people comfort, too. You know, imagine going to the doctor, and he's like, "Oh, my God, I think it's the red tube I got to put in there."
Exactly.
You'd be like, I think that's comforting. You know, like I've been in shows where I feel like where there's a really capable leader, I feel like I'm in good hands. And then I've been in other shows where the guy's a wreck and it's like, this is not working, you know? So I think you need that in any profession, you know, to succeed, man. Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you came back to Canada for Max Webster. Once you got back, what were some of the challenges early on with getting Max Webster launched?
We had to do cover tunes and stuff like that to get work. That's just the way it was. There was a really healthy bar scene around Toronto. There would be a dozen places to play. And then from there were high schools we could still play in, but we had to play stuff that people knew. So we that was kind of the challenge to get work to play your Suffragette Cities by David Bowie and stuff like that. But we were writing and doing our own stuff too a little bit. What I loved about that time, so that's kind of the challenges. It seemed like a pretty sweet time of a new band growing and starting to gain popularity, and the more popular we started to get, the more original stuff, and the more original stuff we started to do, a beautiful thing happened as more people came, as opposed to like, yeah, they're doing their own stuff. It's like, wow, no, that's amazing, this is amazing. So that was a cool time to be able to be doing your own stuff. So,
and this next question, I know you've been asked this 100 times, and I apologize in advance. This is the only question I hope that you'll have been asked a bunch of times. Obviously, at a certain point, you came to the conclusion that the band had run its course. Was there like a straw that broke the camel's back, or because I think that takes a lot of courage, to be honest with you, to disassemble any, whether it's a marriage, a band, that's together that long and you've got a lot invested in it.
Yeah. I wouldn't say there was one straw or something. We were opening up for Rush a lot, and we were managed by the same people, and Rush were becoming quite famous, and the attention was solely on Rush at you know, so we were kind of getting left in the dust, I felt, and I was kind of creatively burned out and just wanting to come off the road. Plus I was having a couple personal problems with my lady back at home, who ended up being my wife and mother of my two wonderful boys. So I thought, okay, it was in Memphis, and I just went, that's enough. But it was right at a time where I think Max Webster was kind of on the verge of we were headlining the Odd Show, but I think that was just going to break open real soon. We're going to head over to the Hammersmith Odeon and do our own show in England and a couple places in Germany and stuff like that. And throughout the States, we had some cities where we could go in and headline sort of small theater. So that it was right on the verge of that, but I pulled the plug and I just wanted to go home and write.
Good for you, man. I think that, like I said, I think that's not an easy thing to do.
No, it's not. And we had great times with Max. I mean, we did Battle Scar with what everyone says. Hey, I like when you did Battle Scar with Rush. No, Rush did Battle Scar with us.
All right. You were kind enough to send me some like funny or interesting talking points, so I wanted to go over some of them.
Sure.
Riding in a yellow Volkswagen Beetle with Joe Walsh in Memphis to find out if he would produce your Rockland record.
That's right. The label kind of went, we were looking for a producer at the time, and the label went, you know, maybe Joe Walsh should do this. He's kind of looking for a project. And so we went, yeah, sure. And then he kind of forgot about it. And the phone rings one night at home, and my wife picks up the phone. She goes, there's a really weird guy on the phone, and he's asking for you. And I said, okay, what's his name? She goes, Joe somebody. And I said, ask him if it's his last name is Walsh. She said, yeah, it's Joe Walsh. So I said, pass me. I get on the phone, and all Joe said to me was, hey, you want to make a record? I went, sure. He goes, all right, let's make a record. And he hung up. That's all he said. And then the label arranged everything. Like, okay, Joe wants to meet with you at his studio in Memphis and blah, 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 blah. So you get to the airport, and there's Joe and his bud. And they're going to take me to the Peabody Hotel, and they put me in a presidential suite and everything. I'm not used to this kind of treatment. But I'm jazzed because I'm Joe Walsh
and
Barnstorm and fan. Like, man, what a groovy guitar player, dude. So we're walking out, and all of a sudden we walk up to his friend's yellow Volkswagen. And I'm like, okay. And there's guitars in the back. Like, so I'm like, I said, and they said, and Joe goes, yeah, sit in the middle. So
in the front,
sit in the middle,
on the stick shift. What the hell?
Yeah, that's exactly. So Joe's on the passenger side, and we're like this. It's like shoulders mushed together, gear shift going on in between my crotch. And that was my fantastic ride with Joe Walsh to the Peabody Hotel and then to his studio. And we went over the demos for a few hours, and everything he said was just so genius and so like, oh man, this is so great. But he was having trouble also with a girlfriend, I think it was a chick, and he kept leaving the studio. So he kept getting distracted, and this was happening for 4 hours. And finally I just went, dude, you seem like you're having a lot of trouble with this person. So I'm just going to go back to the hotel and I'll grab the next flight. If you want to continue this at some point, let's do it. And he said, okay. So that's what happened. And then spool ahead a couple decades later, I'm opening up for him. And he's at the catering table picking away at, you know, some ham and some crackers or whatever. He's looking down at the food. I went, Joe, I said, do you remember blah, 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 blah? And he looks up at me, goes, no. I was crushed.
Oh, my God. Yeah, well,
he said those were crazy times, yeah. Man. I was so strung out and burned out. And then he stops and then he goes, so how are you anyway? And I was like, it's okay. You don't have to make small talk, man. You're at the catering table. Have a great show.
Yeah. That was very smart. How old were you then when you did that?
Rockland. I don't know what year was that. It's not the 80s. So, I don't know. How old was I? 30s, 40s, 40s, 30s. 40s.
That was pretty pretty mature to do that. Because, like,
to do what?
Well, to just say, hey, man, this doesn't seem like it's a fit right now. Just, I'm going to go back home. And, but I mean, that was the right thing to do. But like, you know, you're a young kid and you got Joe Walsh. It was very tempting to probably sit and say, oh, let me make this work somehow.
But I'll put up with this. But no, he was very distracted. He kept leaving the studio, and I felt for him because he seemed really troubled.
Yeah.
Every time he came back, and I was like, oh man, it's okay. Like, you know. So yeah,
that was cool of you to do that. All right, Gene Simmons quote.
Okay.
Not a shy Canadian. About why Max Webster never opened up for Kiss.
Sure, I got to ask him once. I said, Gene, why didn't Max Webster open up for Kiss? And he said, because you guys could play. That's what he said.
Wow.
Now, that's Gene. That's him being nice. That's him being showbiz. He's got lines for everything. So I know deep down inside, we both know you're hugely famous and successful, and it doesn't matter where you are in the spectrum of musicianship or where I am. It is what it is, but thank you for saying that. That made me laugh.
Yeah, that was very tactful of him.
And I mean, a lot of times, you know, Craig, I didn't know that any of these people even knew who I was. I saw Paul Stanley come off an elevator once in Canada here, and somebody said, oh, Paul, this is Kim Mitchell. And he goes, oh, Kim Mitchell, go for soda. I love your work. I'm like, what?
Wow.
Freaked me out. The same thing with Neil Sean, and we're doing a gig with Journey, and at the crew meal, I'm kind of looking at my band going, hey, he's like right over there. I want to go say hi to him, like introduce myself, because I'm such a fan of his playing and his writing, and he owns his own piece of musical real estate and all that jazz. And my drummer went, he probably knows who you are. And I'm like, no, he doesn't. He goes, well, then go say hi. And exactly the same time, I stood up, he stood up, and he came over like, Kim Mitchell, nice to meet you, man. I really love your work. And I was like, and my drummer's going, see, I told you.
That's so cool. That's nice, man.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. These people are so nice most of the time.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. All right. As a Black Sabbath fan, I want to hear this one. Being invited into a Black Sabbath playback of a tune they were recording, as well as the scariest gig opening up for them.
Right. Okay. So Black Sabbath were in Toronto, Canada, doing some recording. And I can't even remember the album. All I know is we were in the middle of our record, Max Webster record, Mutiny Up My Sleeve. And we were doing overdubs, and they were in the main studio. And Ozzy was in the lounge. I kept seeing Ozzy in the lounge. And he was, I think his father was sick and maybe even dying at that point. So he was just in the lounge, always on the phone, and kind of the TV was on. So we didn't spend a lot of time sitting in there. Didn't want to sort of leave him alone. And then Tony Iommi walks over to our studio and went, hey, nice to meet you guys here. We just cut something. You want to come in and have a listen? I'm like, what? Really? Okay, sure. And there we were in the main studio, and they had just cut this track. I can't remember the details because my mind was kind of blown at the time. And like, hey, Harris, sit here. You know, in the middle, sit here in the middle. And they just cranked the piss out of it. And I just got lambasted with a brand new, fresh Black Sabbath tune. I was just like freaking out.
That's pretty cool. Did you get to talk with Iommi?
Just a little bit. But, you know, sometimes these moments are, it's like going really fast on a motorcycle. Like you don't really remember a lot about it other than you were there and it happened. And, so I can't remember what we said. It was the same thing meeting Mick Jagger. It was like, talked with him for like 5 minutes. I was like, well, what did you talk about? Like, I can't remember. He was just saying he had meetings in Toronto and stuff like that. But yeah, it was a nice moment. And then we opened up for them in Leeds.
Oh.
Leeds. And it was, first of all, the gig's scary just because it was like, looked like an underground parking lot. And it was like a low roof and everything is concrete. And I'm kind of standing backstage as they open the doors, and the scariest audience just starts running towards the stage. That moment of where they open the doors, like, ah! And I'm just looking. I haven't seen people like this in my life. I'm from Canada. And this is like, there's like chains and hair sticking up and, you know, things, you know, written on them. And I'm like, oh my God. And I started to freak out. And I went back in the dressing room and I went, man, they're going to kill us. We're going to get eaten alive here. We're just like frostbitten Canadians. This is going to be this is going to, well, I don't know. Well, we might not even get out of here. And we ended up going over great. We went up there and, you know, you're terrified the first tune, but we thought, you know, we came out with Hangover or something off the first album, and it was just kind of riffing away and rocking out. And they were all of a sudden like, okay, we'll put up with this for 30 minutes.
You know? And it was cool.
And it ended up being cool. Sometimes not so cool. I got bullets thrown at me in Detroit. In Chicago, the gig went rough, but
what happened?
You have your money. In Chicago or Detroit?
You pick.
Okay, Detroit. Yeah, it was. We were the first band. We were the first rock band to play Joe Louis Arena, and because it was opening up for Rush, and
that's tough, man. That's a tough to open up for a band that popular, man. That's like opening up for AC/DC.
It's tough. Anyway, so we did it, and in between songs, the lights would go out, and I kept feeling things bouncing off my chest, off my head, my face, and I hear a thing like bang on the guitar. Finally, I looked down, and there's like bullets at my feet.
They were throwing bullets at you.
Yeah, some dude was throwing bullets, which reminds me of Alice Cooper in The Chicken Story. He told me, he says, "Who brings a chicken to a gig?" It's like, "Have you got the tickets? Have you got this? Have you got the chicken? Okay, that's great." Yeah, so Bud's leaving. Hey, so we got our tickets? Great. Okay, we got a bus ticket there? Yeah, great. And we've got the bullets for the opening act that we're going to throw at.
Yeah. You know what, man? You're right. I often think, like, where does that originate, man? Like, how did that fucking creep into your mind? Like, I'll bring bullets with me to throw at the opening. You know, you really wonder, like, what's going on inside someone's head? Like, how does that originate? How do you tie going to a concert to bringing bullets, right? Or a chicken?
Yeah. But the thing is, we went over good in front of Rush. We used to do well in front of them because, as popular as they were and were getting, we sort of had our opening act trip down.
Okay.
And Neil Peart, every night, Neil Peart would play with us. That was his warm-up. He scrimmed his drums. And he said, "Do you mind if I play your set?" So every night he'd play our set without his mics turned on, obviously. But so on stage, we had two drummers the whole set.
That's wild.
And it sounded great. Neil would be warming up, and the audience just thought, "Oh, it's back up," so we couldn't hear it.
That's really cool, man.
Yeah. That's my big memory of Neil.
Moving to the back of a club.
Am I babbling too much? First of all, Craig, am I babbling too much? So you can edit some of this.
No, man, this is great. Okay. If I was hanging out with you, this is a conversation that I'd want to have.
Okay.
No, man, this is great. Okay. I mean, you're the guest on the show. People want to hear about you, not me. You know, I don't have any concert stories.
Sorry if I'm babbling.
My concert stories with Joe Walsh and Black Sabbath are not as good as yours. Moving from the. Spitting all over the place like I'm two. Moving from the front row to the back of a club while watching Alan Holdsworth play.
Okay, so music is about transmitting energy and being moved.
Yeah.
And Alan, I remember sitting in front, I think it was a club in the States or England. I saw him in England too on a night off. And I remember my feet could literally touch the stage. It was 2 feet, and I was kind of just off to his right. So I heard the PA. The PA was right there and sort of off access to his amplifier speakers. And I was a fan already, and I was just sitting there watching him, and it just got so musically intense. His cording stretching, you know, 7 frets, and his legato, 4-finger legato stuff, not 3, 4 fingers. And just what he was playing, I was like, what is going on here? Like, as a musician, I wasn't comprehending. I mean, it was a beautiful feeling. It's just like, you always have that thing in your head going on as a musician. How can I play that? What's he doing? What mode? And I couldn't figure any of it out. So I was just like letting it wash over him. I was like, and then he started just into this chord solo thing. The band kind of stopped, and he was doing those chord swells with delays. And I got freaked out. I kind of got overwhelmed, freaked out, started to get anxious. I went, I got to move. This is just too intense. I can't handle this one more minute.
Wow.
So I got up and I moved to the back to sort of like catch my breath. And I was like, give me a shot of something.
Yeah.
I had a shot of whiskey and had to chill out because it was the first time music just kind of frightened me. It was so intense.
Have you had something like that happen again with anybody else? That was pretty cool, huh? That was cool there, man. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome, man. Yeah. This is funny. When you choked and you couldn't play on a James LaBrie session, James LaBrie is the singer of Dream Theater, with John Petrucci, the guitarist of Dream Theater, sitting on a couch in the control room.
That's right. So it's up in Canada. James has this studio set up in a cottage on a beach up here. It's summer. It's beautiful. It's like, he said, hey, man, I got a cottage. You know, I'm doing a solo record. Come on up and play on it. And he says, I want you to do one of your like slow melodic solos like you play in All We Are. I'll send you the track. And I kind of heard the track a little bit. I'm like, okay, I think I can do this. Yeah, I've tried a couple things. I went, okay, pack up. Up you go. As soon as I walk in the place, there's Petrucci sitting on a couch in the back. And I'm like, all right. I'm like,
That's pressure.
And I'm like, what am I doing here? Like, he can play. What? Why did he ask me? He goes, oh, man, because you know how to. He says, I don't want that speed. He looks back at Petrucci and goes, I don't want what he can do. He's like shredding away. He said, I want you to do your thing. So I'm like, okay. And I rolled off about six takes and couldn't get to the end of the solo. Nothing was working. And I could tell the vibe from the couch was like, what's this dude doing here? Well, I can do this. And I choked and I just went, I looked at the producer, James, up at the board, and I just went, you know, man, it's okay. I'm kind of choking here. I didn't say anything about Petrucci but that's really what was happening. I was just too nervous and too uptight to play. So I bailed. I just went, I'm just, you know, go ahead. You know, maybe some other time. But thanks for the offer.
That's good, man.
They took the check and I just gave it back to him. And
oh, you
the
did?
$300 or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not going
to
take it.
No, that was cool of you to do that, though. Yeah. Wow, that's interesting. Man, that was good of you to like just say, hey, this is not.
Well, it wasn't happening.
Yeah, but I don't think people do that enough. I mean, it's okay to say no. It's okay to say this doesn't work.
Yep.
And people are very sometimes afraid to do that. Like you did with the when we talked about earlier.
Here's the deal is in music, when you're adding instruments, you have to be adding something. And not only was I not I knew right away I wasn't adding anything, and I was making it worse by freaking out. Part of my brain was like, that's John Petrucci back on the back couch there. And maybe he was sitting there going, well, this guy's pretty good. But I'm a Canadian. I'm going, oh, no, he thinks I suck. And this is so, I was sweating. I just got out of there.
Yeah, if you're sweating, that's just not even a good vibe to be in.
No. Luckily, there was a beach close by, so I probably could have jumped in the water, but I didn't. I just got in the car and like, start the car!
why recording 11 to 5, like daytime hours, works better than burning the midnight lamp?
Okay, that was something I learned from my producer of the last record, Greg Wells, who, you know, I said, so, yeah, we have your studio. I'm only down here a week right now, and so I'm ready to go from 10 in the morning till 2 in the morning if you want. He goes, no, we'll work from 11 till 6. He says, it will be a better record. And he was right. He said, yeah, at 6 o'clock, you're going to go for dinner. I'm going to go home, and you're going to walk around Culver City and enjoy California, and I'll see you in the morning, and things will be better. And he was right. He was right. It's a work ethic that I have adopted since it. You know, as musicians, we've all spent the time learning our craft where you get up out of bed at 9:30, 10 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock at night, you're still in your underwear. You haven't eaten, and you feel like something crawled inside your mouth and died. But, and it's like, whoa, okay, that's okay. But if you're making a record, it just works better.
Interesting.
Shorter hours, yeah.
It's funny you mentioned about musician hours. when I first started the show, I don't take calls after like 8 o'clock because I just, I want a life, right? But my phone would ring like 11 or 12 o'clock at night. I was like, who's calling him? I'm like, oh, it's the musician. She goes, what's wrong with these guys? Why do they call you so late? I'm like, he probably just woke up.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, he doesn't know that I'm on the East Coast. He's probably in LA or whatever. And yeah.
It's, sure. Yeah. Yeah,
totally. Yep. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah. We have our weird hours. That's for sure, man.
It is what it is, man.
Yep. It's okay.
What would you tell? Oh, I'm going to ask you this one because Beatles record. You only have one Beatles record, Rubber Soul.
Yeah. Yeah. This was me when I was a kid living in Sarnia, Ontario. Sarnia, Ontario, Canada was right across. It was a border town right across from Port Huron, Michigan. Port Huron, Michigan was 40 minutes from Detroit. I was raised on Detroit rock and roll and Motown. And Motown just resonated with me as a young kid. I remember being like 10 and 11 years old with a little transistor radio, and it's only in mono. So you have one earpiece and listening to Motown. And those were the records I wanted to buy and wanted my parents to buy. And so I got to buy Four Tops and Supremes and Temptations. And all my friends had Beatles records. They're like, hey, man, come on over here, Sergeant Pepper. And there's just Rubber Soul. I had one Beatles record. And it was Rubber Soul. And I think it was just because there's some sort of cohesiveness or flow to that record that I really enjoyed. But I really, Sergeant Pepper and all that stuff, all those concept records, I really got turned off by for some reason, and there were great songs on it, but the idea of a concept record was something I'm not sure why. I just kind of like, I don't want to listen to a concept record. Plus, all my friends had the Beatles records, so if I wanted to hear anything, I would walk across town to go hear it, but the only one I remember going across town to actually do that to was when a bass player friend of mine went, hey man, I just picked up Live at Leeds by The Who. Do you want to come over? I was like, yeah.
Great record.
I'm walking over. That thing just plowed me right under. It's still one of the best live records ever, I think.
They finally released the whole concert, which I'm sure you know already, because the record only had like 4 or 5 songs on it. And it was way too short. What a great, power in a bottle, man.
Yeah, it was amazing. So, yeah. I'd rather listen to that than Old Blood, the Old Blood Dog.
You know what I got to tell you?
There's nothing wrong with that stuff. There's two, okay, go ahead. You were going to say.
Always people say Stones or Beatles. I take the Stones every time.
Sure.
Yeah.
Same with you and Billy Gibbons.
Yeah, I'm just not... I mean, the Beatles songs are nice, but they never like moved me, so I understand exactly.
Yeah. And there's two kinds of hip sway. I find there's a side to side hip sway, and that's okay. There's music that works for, but then there's the front to back hip sway. It's that, that pulse. And I found Motown music did that to me. And,
yeah.
The other stuff did. Of course, a lot of great rock and roll came out of Detroit. It still does. MC5. As a kid, I opened up for the MC5.
Oh, did you? What were those guys like?
Oh, man. I had something profound happen to me during that show. First of all, let's spool ahead for a second. I got to tell little Steven this. He was on my radio show once. And I said, he mentioned something about the MC5. And I just offhand went, I opened up for them when I was like 15. And he stopped and went, did you just say you opened up for the MC5? And I went, yeah, in Ann Arbor. And he goes, man, your cred just went up. But we opened up for them in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And the National Guard was around. And we all shared the same dressing room. And I remember going over to Brother Wayne Kramer, kind of all shy. And like, he was changing the strings on a Stratocaster. And I said, the goofy nerd question. So, how often do you change your string? I was walking up to a woman, right, going, you come here often?
Total
fail.
Where'd you get that blouse?
And he goes, and meanwhile, the MC5 stompers were with him. No, not many people knew about these. They were these ladies who looked after the band, made their clothes. They were the girlfriends, and they were the band called them the MC5 Stompers, because anybody who tried to get into the camp, their little thing, they'd stomp them out. And so anyway, he was really nice. He said, I change him every show. And I said, oh, I said, I said, you, why would that be? And he, well, he says, I slammed the piss out of my guitar. He said, I will break strings the second and third show. I know that. And I said, okay. And that, this is a profound moment, Craig. I watched them, and by the third song, his guitar, and I hope I word this right, was so beautiful and sweetly out of tune. I went, there's nothing sweeter sounding than a Stratocaster out of tune. And it's the only instrument to me that can be out of tune and still like go, oh, it's so amazing. As a matter of fact, I like a Stratocaster kind of out of tune more than I like a really in tune Stratocaster.
That's great.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah, sure, man. If it, whatever floats your boat, if something makes, you know, there's no, to me, man, there's no, I don't think there's making sense in anything, whether it's music or religion. If you like it, great, man. Good. If it makes you feel good, fuck, wonderful.
Yeah, you know? Like some of that old Hendrix stuff where he's live and he's playing out of tune. It's like, I don't mean the Star Spangled Banner, but you know, some of the stuff is like, whoa, that G is like, I just sounds so great to me. It's just bigger and more expressive. And it's like oozing with mojo to me.
Yeah. It's funny. If you listen to Jazz Cats, though, those guys are super sensitive to that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have much less tolerance of that than,
well, in Canada, Craig, you don't play jazz, you commit jazz.
You commit.
It's an offense here.
It's an offense. That's great. You know, I think he still has the MC5 Stompers because I got referred to Wayne and he's to come on the show and he wanted to come on. He goes,
oh, you should. Oh,
he said, call my wife. And I called her. She never returned my call twice. So I think the Stompers are still there, man.
He married one. Oh, man.
I'd love to have him on. Yeah, it'd be an interesting story.
Oh, yeah, it would be so cool, man. So cool. Yeah.
His book just came out a while ago. You know, I was going to read the book, all geared up for it. And, you know, so not going anywhere. I'm sure he'll come around.
The most explosive thing ever. They just exploded on the stage. It's rare you see that these days. It's just like, you know, not a big light show. There's no big production. It's just like, wow. And, oh, man, it was amazing. I get chills thinking about it.
Well, it's a good segue to the next question, and it's a tough question. Top three experiences you've had musically.
So we're talking about things I saw?
Things you saw, or things you participated in, things you were a part of. Whatever, you like, knee-jerk reaction.
Well, okay, sure, knee-jerk reaction would be just jams that, those moments where you deeply connect with the musicians you're playing with. I think that's what we're all after as musicians. That's the thing that's going to give us the most satisfaction. And you can get that in a garage with a case of beer. You can get that on a stage in front of 20,000 people. The dude who has his band, in the garage, and then they connect musically. That's the exact same feeling as a Celine Dion or a U2 or a Kim Mitchell or a Rush are feeling when they connect. The only thing different is the numbers. So my first thing would be when that happens, and that happens often. I'd have to say Alan Holdsworth in there that night was where I got scared. That was a crazy ass moment. Seeing Anna Trebko, a Russian opera singer at the Met in New York City. I was a fan of hers. I was turned on by a girlfriend's family, and I just fell in love with her talent and her mojo. Is there's opera, and then there's Anna Trebko. She's like in a different stratosphere when she walks out in the presence and the voice and how she expresses it. There's been concerts along the way too, but I haven't really done a lot of studio work with people, so I can't say, oh, when I did this with such and such.
Sure.
you know, every time I played on somebody's record, my part was buried, so I just stopped doing it.
What were some of the the jams that you had with others that come to mind? Tell me one or two of those.
Okay. So it was the drummer Max Webster. Him and I booked a little place, a friend's cottage who had some gear in it, and we said, let's go out for the afternoon. And we went out there and we had a jam. We started jamming, just him and I, no bass, nothing. We're just freewheeling. Ready? Go. Okay, here we go. And it got so deep and we enjoyed it. It lasted about maybe 10 minutes and we're supposed to be there all afternoon. And when we stopped, even the way it ended and fizzled out, we were kind of connected and right down to the last little same thing. We went, that was pretty amazing. I really enjoyed that. And he was like, yeah. So what do you want to do? And he said, I don't want to do any more. Let's just go home. I'm like, okay. So after 10 minutes, we're going to be there the afternoon. And this is one of the moments I'm talking about when you really connect. And that was a beautiful moment I remember in my life. And it's funny how you remember those moments, that they stay there, those intense musical
moments. Yeah, that's great. Any other one that comes to mind?
I don't know, just sometimes all we are, you know, I'm playing the solo and it's just a nice feeling.
It's an incredible
playing solo, that solo. I just sort of let it go and it's a slow song. I'm not shredding in it. It's just floating. I love serving the song. I love serving songs. You know, I love schooled players. I won't mention their names, but the guys who are really, really efficient and textbook incredible, and yet they'll serve the song.
Yeah.
But some don't. Some of them are like, look what $6,000 at GIT gets you. Look what this. And music.
Okay. That's great. No, that's great,
music,
man.
Music becomes a vehicle for them to do their thing over, which is fine. They've paid money for it. They've worked on it. And it's valid. I love listening to that. But I also love when someone just serves a song, like a Doyle Bromholt.
Yeah.
The second. He's one of my favorite guitar players because he serves his song. It's like he's so greasy and there's so much mojo, and it's like you have to do that. If it's a song, you got to serve the song. You got to take whatever you know and do what's right. You know who else said that? Is Tom Bukovec.
Yeah.
You know Tom Bukovec, that name? Nashville session player. He's like, you know, I listen to these cats, they all have their, he talks about this. He says, I have, you know, they all have their own headphone mix they can dial in. He says, I'll listen to some of the other cats' mix. And he said, they got the vocal way down because they're coming up with these cool parts and playing these neat things. He says, man, I just crank the vocal. He says, and everything I play is a reaction to the vocal. And that's probably why he gets called all the time.
Yeah.
Because he's serving what the song is about. I think that's important.
Hey, man, I think you're going to come into money. I saw you scratching your...
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, I am scratching. I'm sorry.
No. I think that means you're going to come into money.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah, it does.
Does it? Okay.
It does. You call me 1 week from today. The cards don't lie.
What do you want? Remember, what did I say? A drummer I just had playing something. Greg Morrow. He's a Nashville.
I know Greg. He was on my show. Everybody loves that. Yeah. He's the busiest motherfucker in the world. He was out with Seeger from Detroit. I mean, he's.
We had dinner. He was in Toronto with Seeger. He's on my album, Itch. That's him playing drums on that.
He's playing on everything, man.
Yeah. Anyway, I say he's on a song, Two Up to Be Down, on this album. I said, Greg, what do you want to do it? And he goes, everything you have plus 30%. I love him. He's such a cool cat.
He's so humble and so melt. Like, he's the most unsuspecting. Like, you'd never know what a rock star that guy is, man.
No, you'd never guess that he is a musician at all, other than he has a bit of hair.
Yeah.
You know.
That's fine. Yeah, let me make a note, man. I'll send you that interview because it was really nice. He's a very nice guy. We had a nice conversation.
He's a dude that serves the song too, right? He just counts it in pocket. It's all about serving.
That's great, man. It's a small world, even up in Canada. Yeah. It's wild. Yeah. I want to talk about the new record, The Big Fantasize. What prompted you to do and thanks for sharing all our stories. Those are very cool, man. Thank you. What prompted you to do a record after 13 years? And do you think that that big gap is maybe responsible for the record being so great? You know, kind of like how the first record you do is so great in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Interesting point of view you have there, Craig, about that. It was 13 years for sure. I was doing some writing and I was just happy, just as a dancer wants to dance, a painter wants to paint. I was happy just to write and have nothing ever happen to it. I was okay with that. And it wasn't until Greg Wells visited me after a health scare, and on his way back to Los Angeles, I gave him the USB key of shame. I had my demos. You got your demos on the USB key of shame. Greg, before you leave, you don't bring it up. He's like springing on him the last minute. Hey, Greg, I know you're a really successful big shot down there in Los Angeles now. Here's my key of shame with demos on it. If you can give me any feedback on even one tune as a songwriter, it would really help me. And then he emailed me a couple of weeks later and went, I love this stuff. Like, I love every song. Please come to Los Angeles and let's record it at my studio. And he said, this is a side of you that hasn't been exposed enough to your fans. So let's do this. I'm down. I'm thinking, wow, Greg Wells' studio where all those people record. And he's been there 20 years getting specialized gear to make his sound and all this stuff that he does, I think sounds fantastic. He's great ears. He's an amazing drummer, incredible bass player, beyond into a different stratosphere, keyboard player, piano player. And it was an amazing guitar player too. He used to pick up the guitar when he was in my band and get all jealous in the dressing room. How are you doing that, young little 17-year-old?
Part-time.
So he said, yeah, let's do it. So I, with a bit of hesitation, because another album is a lot of work and I would have to finance it myself and everything. But I went, yeah, okay, let's go.
What made you, what timing was right for you? What was it about the thing that just like you got jazzed about it?
Well, it was Greg saying this stuff. As a songwriter and you've done your demos, you're like, hey man, I really like this stuff. But a lot of times people are like, yeah, okay. But Greg was like, oh, I love this part here, this song here, this chorus. Man, some of this stuff is strong. It's like you write this stuff so great. Like, let's get it out. Let's do it. So that's the moment that I went, okay. What makes it so great, I don't know. Craig, thank you for saying that. But all I can say, the process for me, because Greg said this, he says, dude, let's just get this to where you love it. I want to get the songs to where you love them. And if you love them, I'm going to love it. So that's all we did. And we cut the bed tracks pretty quick. And then I came home and finished it.
It's a great record, man. I'm happy that you did that. Happy for you and happy for me that I get to listen.
Thank you. I'm really proud of it. Yeah, I'm really proud of it.
Man, that's really nice to hear you say that, because I know as a Canadian, that's not something that you probably run around saying. No, it's really. That's a good feeling, man, that you could say that. That's great.
It is because you know what was nice about it is, and I hate to bring Greg's name up again, but first of all, I'm in California. I love being in California. I find it to be a creative hot zone. Anytime I've been there, I feel creative, and the whole city is about that. And second, Greg Wells is producing it and he's engineering it and he's playing on it. So right away I can drop my shoulders and go, I don't have to worry about how this is going to sound. I just have to perform. And he's going to get the best out of me because I'm going to be inspired what everything is sounding like.
Yeah.
And it was a real nice song and dance between the two of us. One day there was a moment that he taught me too, a kind of a profound moment where he went, I made a suggestion about a song and he got kind of pissed. And I was like, what? He goes, that doesn't sound like you talking. That sounds like outside chatter from somewhere. And he was right. It was from a manager. Like, so He's like, maybe we should do this and do that. And he's just like, if you want to make this record yourself and listen to that chatter, he says, but when we're in here, you and I working, that's who's in here working. I don't want to hear any record company chatter, girlfriend chatter, spouse chatter. He says, it's you and I. And I was like, okay. And that threw him for a loop. He kind of called the session for the day. He goes, you go and think about that, because I don't want to be involved if that's going to be happening. And I came back the next day and I apologized. I apologize.
Of course.
Right. Yeah. Hey, man, I'm shocked. I have the hotel for 5 more days. We got to make the best of it. So I said, no. And I realized he was right, though. He was right. You know, I said, yeah, you're right. It was somebody from the outside. It's not going to happen again. Let's go.
That's cool that, A, you had someone that knew you so well over such a long period of time to know what's you and what's not. Man, that is such an, like, I know I'm thinking of my relationship with my wife. We've been together so long, and we know we can call each other on bullshit, and it really helps, you know. Yeah. And that you trusted him so much that, yeah, man, that's, you know.
Well, beyond that too, Craig, think about it in musical terms, that how many bands and stuff making records did listen to record companies,
yeah,
listen to outside, and it made for a worse product. Like, just, I'm a believer, get the producer and the band in there, the right producer and the right band, and just let them do their thing. Same thing with the cover on my record. It was like, oh, well, shit, blah, blah, blah. I was like, this guy's done cover after cover. Here's some elements. Let him do his thing.
Yeah.
Just shut up and let him deliver.
Let the pros
do it. Yeah. Let them do what they're doing.
No, I'm a firm, like, I wouldn't, if the guy came to fix my roof, I'm not up on the roof with him saying, hey, man, don't you think you should approach that hole a different way? I mean, no, I believe that. Exactly. Let experts do what they do, man. I totally believe that.
Yeah.
Talk about the first single, Wishes. Man, it is a beautiful track, but I've read the backstory, but people probably haven't heard it. It's a really nice story, if you could share that.
Sure. I'm kind of a believer that all these ideas are floating around in the stratosphere, and they pick us as conduits to bring them to life. I know there's some musicians, Bob Dylan has said that, you know, he doesn't write it. The song kind of just tells him what to do. And I kind of feel like that. And so one day, 10 years ago, I'm in a waiting room, and as opposed to picking up a outdated Reader's Digest, something was telling me to pick up this book of poetry, which I never do. And I picked it up and I opened it up and I saw a poem. First thing I saw was this poem called Wishes by A.C. Child. And
AC
at the
what?
End of it, A.C. Child.
Okay.
Like a children.
Yep.
Like A.C. Child. And by the end of it, I was kind of filling up, because I just loved the poem about, yeah, we can wish for beauty, we can wish for wealth, we can wish for all this stuff, and that's fine. There's other simple things we can wish for too. And this is some of the things it lists. And hopefully some of these you get before you die. And I was just kind of like, wow. That was... So I wanted to write a song around it. I ordered the book. And obviously Amazon wasn't around 10 years ago. I can't remember how the book got to my house. But once it came, I wrote it, the verses, pretty quick. And then went, uh-oh, now that it's a song, it doesn't feel complete. This poem as a poem felt so, just reading it. Now the challenge is, how do I finish the song? Because it's not finished. I feel like it needs a musical deviation. It needs a refrain, a chorus or something. That process took 10 years. Every few months I'd come at it, and it's almost like the song went, no, that's not at all what I'm looking for. Yeah, you're right. Come back a few months later. No, that's not it. And this went on for years and years until the album was being recorded and almost, you know, I was in the final stages and wanted to put it on. And I was playing it right just over here, a couple feet away from where I'm speaking to you in my living room. And I got to the first part where I thought was awkward. Something had to happen different. And I just stopped playing guitar and I closed my eyes and I sort of sang a little melody. It felt natural. And that was like the song went, yes, yes, that's it. More like that. More like you're onto it. Like stick more of that, more of that. And in an hour and a half, I had the thing finished, the musical section in the middle. And it was like, it all fit. It all sounded like it belonged. It didn't sound like here's a piece stuck in here to be stuck in. It was like, no, this is all a complete song now. And it was like this, I felt like song went after so many years. Okay, man, you did it. Finally, it took you a bit of time, but you did it. Thank you. You go that way. I'm going this way.
Is he alive, AC Child? Or is he or she? Or is it a he or she?
I've tried to find out. We don't know. We only know it's public domain. So
interesting.
I've tried to find. So if anyone knows, we're trying to. We're still researching that. We've gone to the publisher of the book and everything. So
that's cool.
I'm hoping eventually we'll uncover something.
Man, well, it's a beautiful song.
I think it was written in the 40s.
It's a beautiful.
Thank you.
Is that the longest relationship you've had with a song?
Longest I've had a relationship with anyone, anything.
That was awesome.
Drummers, 5 years. That's it.
Longest I've had a relationship with anything. That was perfect, man.
Other than my guitar, man, it's been around me forever and comforted me through everything. So.
Well, we'll talk about that in 1 minute. All We Are, that's a live version of a song off your first solo record, Akimbo Alongo. You've Kimbo done this. Logo. What's that?
Akimbo Alongo.
Alongo. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
You've done this live before, but this live version is pretty special. Any reason why you think it is?
The song morphed into something else. From the studio record, we played it. And then when the band members would change, keyboard players would change, it would morph into something else. And I always kept, throughout the years, I loved doing that, letting the band sort of, the input of the band, and just let things kind of go off in a different land. And just all of a sudden I felt like it was landing in a different place again. So we were doing a live show for a radio broadcast and we played it, and I thought, let's record this show. So, well, it was a radio broadcast, of course. So we, and at the end of it, I was like, ooh, I like what's happening here. So I sent it to Greg and I said, would you want to mix this? So he mixed the stuff. And so
it's so pretty, happened. Man. It's so freaking cool. Man. God, it's
so very powerful. So that's part of the record, The Big Fantasize, which will be coming out. There's 9 studio tracks and 4 live tracks.
That's a beefy record, man. 13 tracks. Mm-hmm. Definitely. That's awesome. And then I just want to
hope people like it.
If this is reflective, I don't see how it can't be liked. Best I Never Had. The whole vibe of that song is so cool. It's got a great groove. You got a acoustic, electric on there. The drums are killer on that song. And again, I just thought the mixing was phenomenal. What's the backstory of that one?
Well, remember writing it. I loved the lyric. I saw the lyric first by a dude I was writing with, and I loved the opening line, Manhattan had a satin smile reflected upon your face. And there's a couple sexy lines in there. The sweetness of your lips on mine, the taste of loving you. And I just, the few lines in the lyric, I just started writing with a drop D tuning and sent it over to him. And he said, the guy who wrote the lyrics, my wife and I stopped in our tracks. He says, the opening line with the way you said it, Manhattan. He's just like, whoa, stop. We played it. So right from the beginning of that song, it kind of was hit the ground running, and it was a special song to me. And Greg played drums on it.
Oh,
so that's Greg Wells playing drums in LA.
Dude, the drums are killer.
Yeah, I know. I'm playing the opening riff, and then okay, here come the drums, and Greg just comes in with this doo doo doo. I was just like, oh my god, he just read everything so well on that song. Just beautiful.
It's funny that
watching him play drums to that track was one of the most incredible experiences I've seen. Because, there we were in his studio, and it was just like so grooved and so sitting in the pocket.
Yeah, well, the groove on that whole song was wonderful, man. Really cool.
Thanks, man.
What were some low points or dark periods you've had to deal with, and how'd you get through them?
Okay. You're talking about in my life?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Okay. My marriage ended, my mom died, and my career kind of hit the dirt. around the 90s, guitar solos had gone away, and I was sort of riding a bit of a crest, and then it just, the bottom dropped out. So all three of those things happened at once, and I fell into a dark place. I was on medication for a couple of years, and moved out of the house and went up to a town a couple hours north of Toronto, Canada, on the water, and just started to try and heal. It's a long struggle, but one of the big moments for me was my father one day went, "You know what you have to do to start feeling better?" And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Get up and make your bed every day and do a good job of it." And I started laughing at him right there. I was like, "Yeah, I get up and I make my bed." And he goes, "No, do it and do a good job of it." And that was sort of the beginning of a healing thing for me. As weird as that sounds, get up and do something for yourself and do a really good job of it every day. And it slowly started to pull me out of the slump. So during that time, I also did an album that was called Kemosabe. And it's kind of a depressing record. It didn't do anything, but I somehow got it out. So it was a dark time for me, a couple of years up there. But oddly enough, now I look back at that time in my life, and I almost want to move back there because it was such a place of growth.
Yeah.
You know, I stopped drinking. I stopped doing, I was running. I was going to the gym and, you know, doing everything you have to do to pull yourself out. And one day it lifted. I found out that I couldn't do the medication anymore. When my physician, it sent me into a arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation. And the doctor went, "You can't take these meds anymore because this stuff causes atrial fibrillation, blah, 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 blah." He says, "You're just going to have to pull yourself out of this by thinking positive thoughts." And that's what I did. And every day I tried to find 2-3 times a day where I think something really positive about the world, my life, Earth. And one day I just went, whoosh, whatever the depression was, the chemical imbalance, I felt it in over a 24-hour period just lift, and it's never returned.
So, man,
I'm lucky.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. That was really cool of you.
Well, there's a lot of people who go through that, man. Yeah. It should be. I'm not going to say it. No, it should be a normalized conversation. It really should be.
I agree with you 100%.
Don't hide that stuff. And I told people, you know, I'm not feeling good. You know, told doctors, and it's the first place to start, and because they'll help you.
You know, it's interesting that first of all, I'm sorry for all that shit that happened. Sorry for your loss of your mom. That's I had one period like that in my life where I had like 5 things happen. You know, even if you're a pretty strong person, you could pretty much handle. But when you have like you had 3 things,
multiple.
It's kind of fucking heavy, man. It's like,
yep.
You're only human.
So you've been through it. You're saying you've been through it. So more environmental causes, right?
It was nothing of my own. I mean, you know, I always try to look, first thing I do when I have shit going on, me personally, I always look for what's my involvement, because if I could find something I did to participate, okay, lesson learned, don't fucking do that again. But B, I don't feel like as much of a victim. I don't like feeling like, you know, so in some of these things that would happen, I were involved, but some of them was just environmental. Like I had nothing to do with any of them, you know?
That's right.
And it was just like, but when you get like 3 of them like that at once, it's hard to deal with, man.
It's okay to have a pity party a little bit, though. It's okay. You're somebody dies around you that you love, your mother. So it's like literally own it, man. It's like, I feel fucking terrible.
Yeah.
You know? And,
Thanks, man. It's funny you mentioned the bed. There's been a bunch of articles here about how important that is. Cause I don't know about your kids. None of my kids make their bed. And let me tell you, it would be a cold day in hell if I got out of and did not make our bed, or if my wife, I mean, it's like brushing your teeth. It's just, the articles basically talk about what that does for you is what your dad said. You do It's like you tick off, hey, I started my day doing something good. I accomplished something.
Yeah. Yeah. I may not be feeling well right now, but I'm going to start every day off doing something that's right for. It's just, exactly.
Yeah, because when you feel like shit, making your bed may be all you fucking can do for that day.
Exactly.
But you did it.
Rather than,
but you did it.
Because you when you're not feeling good, you're going to get out and you don't give a shit. You're not going to wash it. You're not going to do anything. You're going to walk away and go sit on the couch and, whatever. It's like, not good.
Yeah. Yeah. Your energy's low. It's funny because I'm constantly on my kids, like, make your fucking bed. I mean, they're all adults now. I can't say it anymore because two of them don't even live here. I can't go into their house and, hey, they don't.
Oh, dude. I have two sons. My oldest son's my road manager and he owns his own place. And you go over to his place, he'll pick out a paper towel and he'll go like wipe off a baseboard. I'm like, what are you doing? He's going, I see some dust and dirt over here. When he comes over here, he sleeps in the basement. It's like, shambles, fucking just like a mess because we're flying somewhere next day and I live close to the airport. I go downstairs when I come home, it's like, what the fuck happened down here? It's
just like, he cleaned it up? What a guy.
No, he doesn't. Oh, he doesn't clean it up at all. These are like fucking bedding everywhere, juice can. He went in the fridge. And
oh, and your house,
he doesn't get. Doesn't give a shit.
I'd be horrified if I stayed at someone's house and I didn't make the bed, put the fucking silverware away, wash the cups. I'm like, it's someone else's house. I'm even more amplified.
Joe Perry told me a story too. Where I interviewed him in radio and he says, I live in a compound a little bit. And he goes, we built a house down the street from on the compound for my son. He says, and we have to call when we're going to visit our son. It's like, hey, can we come down for an hour? Have a drink or something, whatever. And it's like, yeah, okay. But the son, they'll be like watching TV and just the door swings open and the son comes in, heads to the refrigerator and unannounced, uninvited,
Yeah, that wouldn't work. I don't care if my kid comes in, but that would work. It would be reciprocal. It wouldn't be like, oh, well, we got one rule for you, another rule for us. That ain't happening, man. Yeah. Thanks again for sharing that. I appreciate it, man. I'm glad everything's okay now, man. Your dad sounds like an awesome guy, by the way.
Yeah, he was just a pipe fitter and a welder and wanted me to go to school. And when I quit piano, I took piano for a while. And when I quit, he just said, don't ever say to me, I wish you would have. He says, don't ever do that. I said, okay, yeah, shit, I hate piano. lo and behold, a dozen years later, I'm like, Dad, I wish you. He says, no.
That's cool, man.
And he lived to 95, man.
Oh, that's awesome. That's really cool.
95. Yeah.
Let's talk about gear for a few minutes. I have a funny feeling of your answer based on your former comment. Tell me what your go-to guitar is right now. Has this changed over the years? And what other two guitars would round out your top three?
Sure. My go-to guitar live is a Bill Nash S63 Strat with Lawler pickups in it. The thing just has a nice mid-range bark to it. It's a 10-inch radius neck. I'm not a huge fan of Relic guitars, but I've got one and this thing just feels great. It's on the road. It's fine. It moves around a bit, because of the lack of finish on it. So the neck moves around a bit. I also have a James Tyler classic, which is a Strat. I love that guitar too. So that's my second go-to Strat. And I'm in the middle of getting a custom shop Fender Strat. I also have a go-to acoustic right here. I'm not sure even what it is. It's from the 60s and it has no bottom. And I just have this in the house all the time in the living room and pick it up here and there. I'm not sure what model it is. It's just a bit smaller body, but there's something about the carb on the Gibson neck that feels comfortable. And those are my go-to guitars.
You're always a Strat guy.
Pretty much. I do have a Les Paul. And then I had a blue guitar that was sort of a body and a neck. And it was all the parts of a Gibson remember 335s with a coil tap? What were they called? 345s.
345s, 355s, something like that. One okay, had, so a, depending upon if it was semi hollow or all hollow.
Okay. Oh, okay. So anyway, it was, it had the coil tap and I loved that, but I didn't like the guitar. So I ripped everything out and put it in a drawer. And my guitar tech one day went, let me build a guitar with this stuff. And I said, okay. And it became a guitar that I used for decades because it sounded cool. So huge. And yeah, it was a Strat body and or one of those heavy metal necks and just off a body. And yeah, I played, I used to call it Blue. It still is called Blue. And first gig, it was one of those moments in sound check where the sound man came running up to the stage and went, that guitar you're playing right now, this new thing, I don't know what it is. He says that it sounds huge in the band, like the bottom and the inertia from it, but just the bark and the top end chime, everything just like, sounds so beautiful. So I didn't like playing it actually, but because everyone said it sounded so great, I kept playing it.
I just thought, are you going to, assuming life comes back, are you going to be touring again? To promote the record,
I want to. Yeah, I'd love to be in a couple sweaty rock and roll rooms.
Still. God, that would be awesome.
All want to? We all want to do that. Yeah, yeah. But who knows when? Yeah.
I know the whole thing is.
And gear wise, I love my pedals. You know, I don't want to talk about that, but I would like to make mention of Dave Phillips from LA Sound Design in Los Angeles. He built a couple boards for me, and he's pretty ridiculous. And I have a setup that I just love. I'm a big fan of the Van Muren stuff, the Van Muren Jan Ray. And I have their version of the Tube Screamer too that they just put out, which is rare. And I have number 12 or 11 or 13. Yeah.
What do you play through, studio and live?
Okay. Yep. Old JCM 800, 2 4x12 boxes, old 4x12 boxes, with green backs in it. And I have a JMP as a spare. I have a Roy Blankenship sort of plexi, and I just bought a Morgan JS12 that I love.
Joe Morgan from Nashville, I think.
Morgan amps, yeah. Morgan amplification. It's just a combo amp, but the size of the cabinet and just class A, you know, no preamp, just class A hand wired. I just wanted a smaller amp, and it's kind of just big enough that it lights up the room without pissing off the neighbors. It just sounds beautiful, great sounding amp.
See, Americans don't care about pissing off neighbors.
Well, as a matter of fact, truth be told, they just sold the house next door, and I was checking out who is going to be my potential neighbors. And I have my live rig downstairs right now because of COVID, and it's all set up. So I saw some people, and when I thought, well, I don't want them living next door, I go downstairs and I blast.
Right on, man.
And then 10 minutes later, I see the people standing outside by their car talking to the real estate agent, mouthing things like, I can't live next door to that. This is a nice house. Horrifying.
Man, you can make some residual income. You can tell the real estate agent, hey, listen, if you want me to be quiet for showings, you know, it's going to cost you. tell me your top three Desert Island discs. No particular order and just for now.
Okay. I'm going to pick Casey Musgraves. Mm-hmm. Slow Burn. I'd have to pick Electric Ladyland, Jimi Hendrix.
Great record, man.
And Shiny Beast by Captain Beefheart, the one with Bat Jane Puller on it. It's one of the bravest albums ever, I find, musically, because I saw him play in a bar in Toronto here years ago, and another fantastic musical experience that just transcended me into nobody does that. Nobody.
Beefheart? No one ever did anything.
Nobody ever does that, and nobody did it. And that's maybe where I early on got my sort of what I want to do, which is own your own piece of musical real estate. I don't want to chase a trend. I want to find my 12 notes and make them mine.
You stay in pretty good shape. Is that like, do you put effort into, I mean, you're slim, you're always, you know, I watch a bunch of videos. You're always in pretty fit. Is that something conscious?
Well, a little bit sometimes, you know, I try to keep moving. I spent my time in a gym here and there, and I can't do that right now. I can't run anymore. I used to run. But, I'm older and I have a replaced knee. I work on it a bit.
Yeah.
And after having been a heart patient, I have plumbing problems and electrical problems, so I have to watch what I eat. But I also live my life. Like if I see the burger and I want it, I get the burger.
Good for you, man. Yeah, you can't. Not eating the burger ain't going to put you in a coffin, man.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Paul Stanley saying, he's like, oh, his cholesterol's high. My doctor told me I can't eat ice cream anymore. It's like my favorite. He says, you're talking to the wrong guy, man. I love ice cream. I'll cut down some, but I'm not quitting eating ice cream.
Yeah.
I got to live, man.
Got to live, man. Yeah. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself, Kim?
I like my ability. Okay, even though I'm not doing it today, Craig, I think I have an ability to ask people about their lives and to empathize with them. And I like their story. I'm interested in their story. My curiosity for human nature.
You're a great listener, man. You could tell that when you talk to someone. You're a super, I could see why you're good at that because, you know, you're a good listener.
Fuck, man. I think all I've been doing is talking here for way too long.
No, but when you're, no, you could just, you know how you could tell when people are good listeners. You're a very good listener. Yeah, yeah.
Thanks, Buffett. Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you have any hobbies outside of music?
Yes. I have a sports car in the garage, a German engineered sports car, and I love taking it to the track. And I'm not talking about a circular track or a drag strip. I'm talking about a real Grand Prix track that goes up and down and around.
Really?
I love, there's a group of people who do that, and it's a beautiful thing. It gives me, it's just the focus that it takes. And, you know, the first year I did it, you have an instructor beside you all the time, and you have to, you know, you have flag marshals everywhere watching your every move. There's strict rules for doing this. You don't, there's not racing. You're not racing against the clock.
How fast do you go?
Well, I want to watch what I say because insurance companies might be listening.
Like hypothetically, how fast might you want to go?
Hypothetically, one might, you know, well, it's a track with curves and stuff like that. So it's first of all, it's about driver development. I find I'm a better driver on the road. First of all, I don't speed on the road.
Right.
You know, rarely because I get to take it out on the track where it's monitored. You're safe. It's, I feel like it's pretty safe. Anyway, hypothetically, 240 kilometers an hour, 250 sometimes.
What is that in miles? So what is it? Like 100? Well,
160 is 160 kilometers is 100 miles an hour.
Oh my God, man, that is, you can't. I once had an opportunity to drive like really, for me, what was fast, like 100 miles. That is not for the faint of heart, man. You really got it.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
We're not doing that all the time though, Craig. It's there's a back straight on this one track that you drop your shoulders, you can push your foot right down and you don't hang on tight. You just, but the focus, what I love the most, man, is the focus it takes. It's one of the most exhausting things. By the end of the day, you are done.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Wow.
I just love it. That's my little hobby.
That's awesome. Very cool. That's maybe you're only the first or second guy who does something like that I've spoken to. Two more questions, Kim, and I can't thank you enough for all your time. Funniest thing that's happened to you on the stage or in the studio? And you might have shared it already, but.
No, it was on stage once and the end of a song called Rock and Roll Duty. It's a big one of those big bashy rock endings. And I took a step back and hit a crevice in the stage and started going really fast backwards.
Oh, man.
On an angle and couldn't recover. Ended up smashing into my amps, and this is a sold out night. Smashing into my amps, the JCM 800's going over, the cabinets go over, everything. And I'm on my back. And what makes it funny is that it all seems in slow motion as it's happening. And my bass player, my first name is Joe, Joseph Kim Mitchell. And he calls me Joe all the time. He always has. And, you know, security, everybody's running up on stage trying to pick me up. And he just comes over and looks at me and goes, Joe, where are you going? That's all he said.
Joe, where are you going? Said, that's great.
So, because I mean, right, I'm looking up at him and the audience is kind of.
Where was this?
No, there's no, it's a town called Ballet. It was like a resort. Actually, it's a wooden resort, wooden pavilion resort where they used to have big bands play. And there's an X on the stage that says Louis Armstrong stood here.
Oh, that's cool. It's in Canada.
Yeah.
Awesome. Very cool, man.
Sort of a cottage resort. So, I mean, there's always funny laughs along the way. We always laugh at what we laugh at are the guys who in our band who do the Lammy violation, which is you're wearing your laminate pass like in an airport or in a mall or whatever. It's like, no, that's a Lammy violation. You're not supposed to wear your Lammy at the gig. So we'll walk up the guys, you know, because you see bands at airports like, right. Lammy violation. you're posing.
Yeah.
You're posing.
Take your thing off. That's funny.
What are you? Drum tech for some big band?
Is that what you find it usually is?
Totally.
It's always like a C player or like the yeah. That's funny. Cool. Yeah, because you'd figure the main guys don't want to be nobody. They get recognized enough. The last thing they want is more adulation outside of the gig.
Well, a lot of times the main guys are in a private lounge and section, but so we go up and bust their ass all the time. Lammy violation.
Lammy, that's right, man. Hey, last question. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional and how much has been a part of aging?
I think most of it's been aging. Pain-free days are over. I'm 60. I just turned 68. So
you're 68?
I don't feel
Holy
it.
Holy shit,
I don't
man.
Feel it. But,
you don't look it either.
I would have pegged you for at least 90, Ken.
I'm 56. I thought you were like maybe 3 or 4 years older than me. That's awesome, man. Holy shit.
Thank you. Thanks. How have I changed? Man, that's a tough question. I don't know, Craig. I think I'm kind of the same person. I feel a little bit more like I'm one of the Muppets up in the balcony bitching.
You become a curmudgeon.
There's a little bit of that. There's two, three times a week. I have an older dude I call and we get on the phone and we bitch and complain about all kinds of stuff. And it's just kind of funny. We laugh at it. Actually, he makes me laugh when he does it. Okay. What am I? I think I'm maybe a more kind, aware person, it's less about me. I think I'm a good father, to my kids. You know, the marriage ended pretty early and I put in my time. None of it changed in the last 10 years. I give less of a shit. You know, I think we have to. We owe it to ourselves to give less of a shit. And I don't mean I don't care about what's going on in the world. I really do. And but it's, you know, you kind of realize you're kind of handing the baton. That's what I love about it. People are like, well, what do you think about the new music and how, you know, I'm like, I love the way each generation comes in and changes it and says what they want to say in their own way. I love that. I may not buy the records of such and such, but I totally respect what they're saying and how they're saying it, like the way they have to say it to reach their audience. That isn't really answering your question. I'm sorry.
How many apologies have we had here? We may have a Canadian record with you, Kim Mitchell. Listen, man, no, you answered my question. You're like less concerned what others think of you, basically, is what I think you were saying.
Yeah. Especially in this day and age when you can be affected by that by looking online and you just have to give less of a shit and walk with a little more confidence, care about the things that are important, my family and and enjoy the, I think a big change too is enjoying the good earth and the beauty of all that, where you can find it. That's what I try and do.
Right on, man. Hey, listen, I cannot thank you enough for your time and for being so sincere.
Thank you, Craig.
You were so honest when I spoke to you the first time. I knew this would be a good, honest as in like real, and I really appreciate that. Let me tell people what you got going on, and it's Kim Mitchell. The new album is called The Big Fantasize. It'll be out sometime before the end of the year. I think Kim will come back on the show once it comes out, and we'll talk a little bit more specifically about the record. In the meanwhile, he has a single out called Wishes. It is a beautiful song. I'd love you to check it out, and you can find it on kimmitchell.ca for Canada. Also, his YouTube sign up, you know, subscribe to his YouTube channel. Follow him on Facebook and Instagram. It's all under Kim Mitchell, and under Twitter, it's The Kim Mitchell. And the name of the record again is The Big Fantasize. And we'll all look forward to coming. Man, the record's really, really pretty. I'm so happy for you. And thanks again. Anything else that I missed or you want to plug or anything?
No, man. This has been a good hang, Craig.
Thank you.
I really appreciate the work you're doing, man. And I wish you a lot of success.
Thank you very much, man. We'll see you in we'll meet you in Naples.
I hope you get to talk to Brother Wayne Kramer.
I hope so too, man. Like I said, I have his wife's number. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I'm not. I can't keep calling his wife though. I'm not like that. it would be kind of weird. Man, thank you. Hang on one second. Let me say goodbye, right. Everybody. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We do appreciate your support. Please check out. Many thanks to Kim Mitchell, and please check out kimmitchell.ca, his website. Gear up for The Big Fantasize when it comes out, and follow him on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I want to make sure I got everything here. And don't forget, man, especially nowadays, most important, please remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Kim, thank you so much for everything, brother.
I'll see you, man.
We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.